Same unit, the same group that has been going after Black Lives Matter in places like Portland, Oregon? We have 5 seconds.
Yes, it was BARTAC.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Montana Thames, for joining us, humanitarian aid worker with No More Deaths. And we'll continue to show what happens there. And people can go to our website at democracynow.org to get our interviews with Scott Warren after he was arrested. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burkton, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, yeah. John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, I'm Amy Goodman.
Oh,
with
you.
Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector at kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Protests against police brutality and systemic racism continued in Portland for the 68th consecutive day. Nevada's governor has signed a vote-by-mail law, despite threats from Donald Trump. And in international news, an explosion in Beirut, Lebanon, left more than 2,500 injured and 50 dead. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 4th, 2020. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Protests against police brutality and systemic racism continued in Portland for the 68th consecutive day. A crowd gathered downtown near the Multnomah County Justice Center and adjacent federal courthouse, an area that has been the site of nightly protests for weeks. A small group of clergy members and religious leaders also gathered at Salmon Street Springs on the waterfront. In Northeast, a crowd of about 150 demonstrators gathered at Laurelhurst Park, and then marched to the Penumbra Kelly Building, which is used by the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Shortly after 10 p.m., police announced via loudspeaker that people on the property could be arrested or subject to use of force. The demonstration was declared an unlawful assembly at about 11:45 p.m. Dozens of police officers rushed protesters, most of whom retreated off the property. More police followed, pushing demonstrators at least 3 blocks down East Burnside, away from the sheriff's office. Officers could be seen shoving protesters, some of whom fell to the ground. Police also appeared to be using pepper spray while making arrests. Additional reports have surfaced of Portland officers' efforts to intimidate demonstrators, including ripping off face masks before using pepper spray and threatening protesters with social media surveillance. Shortly after midnight, police threw smoke canisters and other distraction devices before retreating. In a New York Times opinion piece, Portland Police Chief Chuck Lavelle says protesters in the city are responsible for what he describes as violence. Lavelle became police chief in June, shortly after the movement began. Lavelle wrote, quote, "These spectacles are drowning out the voices that need to be heard to make positive change. This violence is doing nothing to further the Black Lives Matter movement." Throughout the op-ed, Lavelle uses the word violence 6 times to describe the actions of protesters. He does not place any blame on his police officers, who have deployed tear gas nearly 100 times since late May. His op-ed comes at a pivotal moment when federal troops have begun withdrawing from the city, potentially lowering conflict, but also returning protesters' attention to local law enforcement. The op-ed is in line with Lavelle's previous statements, in which he has distinguished between what he calls peaceful and violent protesters, as well as justifying the use of CS gas against Portlanders. On Monday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 272 new cases of COVID-19 in the state, bringing the total number of cases in Oregon up to 19,366. Health officials also reported 2 new deaths, bringing the state death toll up to 328 people. According to the Oregon Health Authority, the state's percentage of positive tests was 6.1% last week, the highest Oregon has seen since the second week of March. Just last week, Governor Kate Brown announced that the statewide positivity rate must be below 5% for 3 consecutive weeks before schools can resume in-person classes. Officials said the number of tests performed each week in the state is holding steady, but supply chain issues are restricting Oregon's testing capacity, which tops out at about 48,000 tests. The company Novavax announced encouraging results today from 2 preliminary coronavirus vaccine studies. About 2 dozen vaccines have entered the first-round safety tests in humans, known as Phase 1 trials. 5 other coronavirus vaccines are already in Phase 3 trials, which take place on a larger scale. Nationally, over the past week, there have been an average of 60,000 cases per day. As of Tuesday afternoon, more than 4.7 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the coronavirus, and at least 156,500 people have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 18.3 million people in nearly every country. More than 695,000 people have died. A massive explosion occurred today in Beirut, Lebanon, shortly after 6 p.m. local time. Videos posted online show a shockwave erupting from the explosion, enveloping much of the city center in a cloud of dust and smoke. Cars were overturned and streets were blocked by debris. Although the cause of the explosion has yet to be confirmed, Major General Abbas Ibrahim, the head of Lebanon's General Security Service, said highly explosive materials seized by the government years ago were stored where the explosion occurred. There were also local reports that the warehouse contained fireworks. However, this has not been confirmed. Lebanon's health minister, Hamad Hassan, said that at least 50 people were killed and over 2,500 wounded. The explosion also killed Nazar Najarian, the secretary general of the Kateb political party, whose offices are located near the explosion site. The tenuous truce in the Gaza Strip has been aggravated by recent Israeli airstrikes. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell has more.
Radio Havana and Al Jazeera report that Palestinian authorities are still working to repair the damage after Israeli warplanes launched new airstrikes against the positions of the Palestinian resistance movement of Hamas in the central parts of the besieged Gaza Strip. The attacks targeted west of Deir al-Balah city. The sound of several explosions has also been heard from east of Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip. The attacks came shortly after the Israeli military claimed its Iron Dome air defense system intercepted a rocket fired from Gaza toward the occupied territories. The Israeli army said some families watching a film at a drive-in theater in southern Israel had to run to bomb shelters when a small rocket arced toward the area. The Israel army says it struck subterranean Hamas facilities in Gaza in response, while the Palestinian group called it a clear message of escalation. The religious charity Ecclesia issued a statement saying two infant boys have died since coordination between Palestinian and Israeli authorities ground to a halt. Both boys, one 8 months old and the other only 9 days old, had heart conditions and needed surgery unavailable in Gaza, but they did not get permission to receive care in time. Ecclesia said there are currently more than 50 children with cancer across Gaza, 15 of whom are in grave condition and may not survive without receiving treatment soon. Neither chemotherapy nor radiology treatments are available in Gaza due to Israeli restrictions on medication.
That was KBOO's Teresa Mitchell. The social media app TikTok has had a tumultuous few weeks. On Saturday, President Trump threatened to ban the short-form video app on uncertain grounds. TikTok is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance, and as of Monday, Trump has set September 15th as the deadline for the company to find a U.S. buyer, or the app will be banned. Microsoft has emerged as a potential buyer, but the president is now insisting that the government must get a cut. Critics are calling this extortion. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell has more.
Chinese authorities are loudly objecting to the forced sale of the U.S. division of the social media app TikTok. Wang Wenbin, Chinese foreign minister, called the sale a blatant act of bullying. President Trump has demanded the sale of TikTok as a part of his efforts to shift attention from the pandemic towards China, saying that the sale must go through by September 15th or else he will put TikTok, quote, out of business. TikTok has also become a hotbed of dissent against the racism of the U.S. police and was used by anti-Trump teens to sabotage his rally in Tulsa earlier this year, thereby earning the ire of Trump and his Law and Order platform followers.
That was KBOO's Teresa Mitchell on the potential sale of the social media app TikTok. The Department of Homeland Security and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency are planning to build a new detention facility in the Chicago area and open up a so-called Citizens Academy. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Starting in mid-September, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency will open its first Citizens Academy. A six-week program, the agency says, is an opportunity for residents to learn about ICE policies and procedures. However, Liz Castillo of the group Detention Watch says the decision to launch an ICE Academy in Chicago is not just tone-deaf in the current political environment, but potentially dangerous.
At best, the school will serve as yet another mechanism for the Chicago ICE field office to attempt to cover the harm it perpetuates every day. At its worst, this program, which includes training in defensive tactics, firearms familiarization, and targeted arrests, carries with it a lot of potential to foment racial profiling.
In a press release, the agency says the program is modeled after other law enforcement academies, designed to educate the public and familiarize participants with its mission. Sandra Diaz with the Round Lake Park and Chicago-based Mano a Mano Resource Center says in addition to the Citizens Academy, ICE recently proposed building a new detention facility in the region.
Many of the federal agents that are coming to Chicago are from DHS, specifically from a division under ICE called Homeland Security Investigations, and they are a part of the administration's deportation pipeline.
Meanwhile, Diaz points out the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services office is strapped for cash, and some reports say the agency could run out of money by the end of the month.
If USCIS does shut down, many people will not become citizens in time to vote in the upcoming election, and we can't allow that to happen.
Last week, USCIS announced it's implementing a 20% increase in fees required for immigration and naturalization applications. The fee hike goes into effect on October 2nd. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. Journalists have been violently targeted by police and arrested alongside demonstrators at Black Lives Matter protests across the country. In this episode, we'll get a look at the struggle for press freedoms during a time of repression and surveillance. Then at 6, it's transpositive PDX. And at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 64 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 84 degrees. Today in history, in 1854, Henry David Thoreau's classic Walden, or A Life in the Woods, is published. Although it is required reading in many classrooms today, when it was released, it sold just around 300 copies a year. The quote of the day is from Henry David Thoreau's Walden. Thoreau wrote, quote, "I learned this, at least by my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours." Before the coronavirus hit the U.S., only 5 states, Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Utah, and Washington, conducted elections with a universal vote-by-mail system. Now Nevada's governor has signed a vote-by-mail law despite threats from Donald Trump. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Legislation to expand Nevada's vote-by-mail for the November election was signed by Governor Steve Sisolak late Monday, despite attacks by President Donald Trump earlier in the day. During a special session on Sunday, the Nevada Senate approved implementation of a mail-in voting system. In a tweet following the action, Trump called it a late-night coup and said it should be met with immediate litigation. Sandra Cosgrove heads the League of Women Voters of Nevada and says the group supports broader vote-by-mail this year because Nevadans should not be put at risk of COVID-19.
We want to make sure they have a voting option that lessens or mitigates that risk. And so obviously when you're talking about a pandemic and people really can't be close to each other, mail-in voting is going to be the way that we want them to go.
Cosgrove adds that voting by mail is not a requirement because polling sites also will be open, but there may be fewer of them. The Trump administration has argued that universal vote by mail could lead to fraud, but states where it's allowed, including Colorado and Utah, report little to no evidence of election fraud. Nevada conducted its first all-mail election in June after election leaders agreed the pandemic posed a significant risk to poll workers and voter safety. Cosgrove says for this year only, the new law means everyone will be sent a ballot without needing to request one.
So what we're doing is not permanent. It's going to be written into our law saying that when we're under an emergency order, this will be the election process that we follow.
California, Vermont, and other states also are proactively sending mail-in ballots to voters because of the pandemic. In a statement, Sisolak said he's confident local clerks and registrars will run a safe, fair, and accessible election in November. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Donald Trump threatens litigation against Nevada for passing a bill to mail ballots to all registered voters. Plus, Arizona, Michigan, Washington, Kansas, and Missouri have primaries today. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
When you're talking about a pandemic and people really can't be close to each other, mail-in voting is going to be the way that we want them to go.
Nevada League of Women Voters President Sandra Cosgrove explaining why her state decided this weekend to mail ballots to all registered voters for November's election. President Donald Trump called the law a, quote, late-night coup that would make it, quote, impossible for Republicans to win the state. And he threatened litigation in a tweet yesterday. 5 states actually use the same process all the time. Oregon's used vote by mail for 2 decades with no evidence whatsoever of increased voter fraud. In Nevada, it's for this year only.
So what we're doing is not permanent. It's going to be written into our law saying that when we're under an emergency order, this will be the election process that we follow.
Trump used a news conference to cite huge delays with counting ballots in a New York election as support for his false statements about voter fraud, saying he has authority to stop states from using universal mail-in voting, but, quote, we haven't gotten there yet. Arizona, Michigan, Washington State, Missouri, and Kansas all have primaries today, with mail-in voting plus in-person options. G Gina Roberts with the Arizona Clean Elections Commission says a lot of their job this year was explaining what makes vote by mail secure.
I think that's a lot of misinformation out there right now about the vote by mail system, because all of the concerns that I've seen so far about fraud in the process, I think what we're hearing is that maybe voters just aren't understanding how the process works.
There are some formidable primary challengers to incumbents on the left and right. In Michigan's 13th, Representative Rashida Tlaib, one of the four freshman House Democratic women known as the Squad, will face Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones, who lost to Tlaib by just 900 votes 2 years ago. In Missouri's 1st, progressive activist Cori Bush is taking on 10-term incumbent Congressman William Lacey Clay. And in Kansas, immigration hardliner Chris Kobach is going up against Republican National Committee-backed Senator Roger Marshall. Here's University of Kansas political scientist Patrick Miller.
Kobach is the Republican that Republicans like the most, but he's the Republican who everyone else likes the least.
Kobach lost the 2018 election for governor to a Democrat in the ruby-red state of Kansas. A newly formed super PAC with Democratic ties has been running ads to help Kobach, a staunch conservative, despite concerns that his anti-immigrant positions are too dangerous to elevate.
Obviously, Democrats would probably prefer to take Kobach on because he's a known quantity, and they've already beat him once.
Yesterday, former President Barack Obama announced his first wave of general election endorsements, backing over 100 down-ballot Democrats. Meanwhile, Trump dismissed a new federal filing by Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance, calling it, in his words, a witch hunt. The filing said part of the legal basis for requesting Trump's tax records was reports of, quote, possibly extensive and protracted criminal conduct at the Trump Organization. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to Roz Brown from the Nevada News Service, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Work continues to improve Canada's Indigenous child welfare system. Congresswoman Holland seeks tribal priorities in the next stimulus package, and a flood of appeals have followed the McGirt ruling. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian government and the Assembly of First Nations recently reached an agreement on the road to overhauling the Indigenous child welfare system. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, there are still barriers to overcome.
The agreement was signed in Ottawa by the National Chief of the AFN, Perry Bellegarde, and the Indigenous Services Minister, Mark Miller. It's seen as the next step towards implementing Bill C-92, which set national standards for Indigenous jurisdiction over child and family services, recognizing Indigenous laws and customs. The agreement is also a guide for further talks. Here's the AFN's Perry Bellegarde.
It's about improving the quality of life for our children. We know there's 40,000 children in foster care Right across Canada. And when Bill C-92 was passed, it was about making a difference and making sure that those children were looked after, that they were able to be kept home in their families and communities surrounded by their relatives. And that's really what this is about, making a difference for the children that are in care.
Some of Canada's provinces, however, are concerned about how the agreement might impact their roles in child welfare programs. Quebec, for one, is challenging the constitutionality of the law in court. Bellegarde says talks must also take place with provincial governments to overcome one of the biggest barriers to reducing the number of Indigenous children in foster care. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
As Congress debates the next coronavirus stimulus package, one of the newest Native American members of Congress is seeking to have Indian country a priority. Katie Garceron has the story from Washington.
Last year, Deb Holland of New Mexico became one of the first two female Native Americans ever elected to Congress. She's hoping party leaders listen to their voices now. Holland says coronavirus is revealing how desperately tribes across the nation need things like broadband internet and safe, clean drinking water.
I mean, they need funding, absolutely, but they need it right away. The last time they had to wait while the Treasury, you know, figured out the formula and all of those things. And, it'd be nice if we got this rolling.
Because each reservation has specific needs, Holland says tribes should be able to spend federal dollars as they please. She says this pandemic is helping shine a light on racial disparities across America, which is especially on display in Indian country. Holland says it's disturbing that at one point, the Navajo Nation had one of the highest infection rates per capita in the U.S. because these gaps in Native healthcare have been known for decades now.
This pandemic has just laid bare all the disparities, right? I mean, that's why the communities of color have higher infection rates than other folks. They need more health care they need. They shouldn't live in polluted areas.
Congress is only slated to be in session for 2 more weeks before they take August off. So far, partisan gridlock and GOP infighting over the price tag has left the next stimulus package in limbo. For National Native News, I'm Katie Garceron.
Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter announced Monday he's preparing a brief with the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals seeking guidance on cases following the recent U.S. Supreme Court McGirt ruling affirming Muscogee Creek Reservation boundaries, which has led to tribal, state, and federal jurisdiction questions. Hunter says a flood of inmates are challenging state convictions on historic tribal lands, including lands other than the Muscogee Nation. Hunter says his office plans to challenge every appeal and ask the Court of Criminal Appeals to deny any request by inmates attempting to get released from prison. In a statement, Muscogee Creek Principal Chief David Hill said the Supreme Court decision is about fixing what was broken, not giving criminals a free pass, adding there's much to resolve and pledging to work with officials. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Land and Water Conservation Fund helped the Bureau of Land Management turn the Blackwell Island Recreation Site into a major recreation destination. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
In a major victory for conservation, President Donald Trump is slated to sign the Great American Outdoors Act today. Included in the legislation is a little-known but key program called the Land and Water Conservation Fund that's used for everything from improving access to public lands to funding city parks. Carrie Koska with the Nature Conservancy of Idaho says the program will receive its full funding of $900 million annually.
Passage of this bill is truly a historic and monumental win for conservation and has a lot of people very excited.
Koska says the fund regularly does not get full funding. Last year, for instance, it received $495 million of the $900 million it was supposed to get. Funds are collected from offshore oil and gas drilling. Idaho has received nearly $290 million over the past 50 years from the program, according to the LWCF Coalition. Jeff Cartwright works with LWCF as the Acquisition and Withdrawal Program Lead for the Bureau of Land Management's Idaho State Office. He says there are many examples of LWCF-funded programs across the state, including conservation easements on the Salmon and Snake Rivers to keep those places pristine. He also points to the Blackwell Island Recreation Site outside of Coeur d'Alene.
We basically turned a parcel of bare land, and now it's a massive recreation site with over 40,000 annual visitors, a four-lane boat launch, 130 vehicles, trailer parking, shelters for people to rent out and have parties and picnics at.
Koska says Idaho Republican Representative Mike Simpson played an outsized role in getting this bipartisan bill passed.
Congressman Simpson has long been a champion of Idaho's outdoor and natural places and was a lead co-sponsor for the Great American Outdoors Act in the U.S. House of Representatives.
With the president's signature, additional funding for conservation projects will become available in Idaho soon. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Extreme heat is growing more common due to climate change, and rising temperatures could disproportionately harm Black communities. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms, hot days are getting hotter, often dangerously so, and the risks fall disproportionately on many communities of color. Christina Dahl is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
When we look at counties that have a high proportion of African Americans in the continental U.S., they tend to be concentrated in the southeast region, places like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. Those also are some of the hottest places in our country already.
And they're expected to see some of the biggest increases in extreme heat in coming decades. Dahl's analysis of nationwide data shows that by mid-century, counties with large African-American populations will face an average of 22 more extreme heat days each year than counties with smaller African-American populations. So she says it's important to consider racial disparities when investing in solutions like cooling centers and planting trees.
There are a lot of ways that we can start directing resources to underserved communities and thinking about how we reach them in terms of communications about extreme heat and warning people about those dangers.
Because protecting people from heat is not only a health issue, it's also an issue of racial equity. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 4th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Teresa Mitchell, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, Nadia Romlagon, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show. Host Tori Bortman interviews Kyonda McCorders of Black Girls Do Bike. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
This week on Making Contact. At Black Lives Matter protests across the U.S., journalists have at times been violently targeted by police and arrested alongside demonstrators.
I was so shocked to see such an egregious violation of basic First Amendment rights of reporters trying to just cover a protest. One of the things that we noted is that then legal observers started getting picked up and arrested as well. And so it kind of echoed the way journalists were being targeted. Any effort to document or observe or provide witness to what was happening at these protests, officers were trying to limit and clamp down on.
And later in the show, we'll hear from Dave Moss at the Electronic Frontier Foundation about a project he's been working on to track the use of police surveillance technology in local communities.
When we talk about defunding the police or we talk about reducing police budgets, one of the big things that police departments spend money on is surveillance technology.
Journalists are considered essential workers. Yes, in a democratic society, a free press is essential. But specifically during the BLM protests and COVID-19 pandemic, reporters were exempted from curfews as essential workers in many cities. Not all of them. In the cities where reporters were exempt, they were supposed to be allowed to report on events on behalf of the public. But we've heard a disturbing number of accounts of journalists being arrested and attacked by police during the Black Lives Matter protests. It had gotten so bad that the ACLU of Minnesota filed a lawsuit this summer against the city of Minneapolis on behalf of journalists. But as Making Contact producer Salima Hamarani reports, it's not just a problem in Minneapolis.
Fired at with rubber bullets. My cameraman has been hit.
You're listening to police knock down two journalists on assignment for Australia's Channel 7. They were covering the Black Lives Matter protests in Washington, D.C., when a police officer hit the cameraman with a shield.
Whoa!
Amelia, can you hear us?
Amelia, are you okay? Or your cameraman? Hello, Amelia.
The incident was captured live and went viral, prompting a harsh response from the Australian government and shock from around the world. But it's just one instance of what's becoming a pattern during the protests. Police seeming to target and attack journalists, even while the journalists are clearly filming and wearing press badges. We got to talk to Christopher Matias, a journalist who covers the far right for Huffington Post, about his experience in Brooklyn, where he was also arrested for trying to cover a protest.
It was on May 30th, and it was at a protest march in Flatbush, which is a section of Brooklyn. It started off as a rally near a train station about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then around dusk, there started to be clashes with police at various corners. Some cop cars were set on fire, and police routinely started to charge at protesters and pepper spray them and tackle them and arrest them. Now, I witnessed cops like charge after protesters screaming, "Come here." You know, I saw them pepper spraying protesters while protesters were retreating. I saw them violently tackle people on the ground. The cops were charging, and I was walking backwards with the retreating protesters and filming as the cops approached. And a cop kind of went out of his way to bump into me and told me to get out of his way, even though I was never in his way. I was a little worked up from everything I had seen that day, so I said, "F- to the cop." He was already 5 yards past me when he turned around and came back and put a police baton into my chest and knocked me over. My phone fell out of my hand, and a few cops kind of climbed on top of me and started twisting my legs and arms in different directions and cursing at me and telling me to stop resisting arrest, even though I was not resisting arrest.
"I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine.
Give me a hand.
They're right here. Please get my phone. I can't get it. I can't get it around. I can't get it around."
And by the way, I should mention that my press pass was clearly visible during this entire thing, and I also kept identifying myself verbally as a journalist.
"If you look at my press pass, I'm a journalist. You're arresting a journalist right now.
Then you should have gotten out of my way."
The police arrested Chris, and then they put him in the back of a police van.
And then to the police precinct where, you know, I was in custody for probably for 3 hours at two precincts. They put me in a cell with about 15 other guys, and we were put in a tiny cell where it was impossible to socially distance. Most people, you know, didn't have masks or weren't supplied with masks. I ended up getting a test after that experience. Unfortunately, it came back negative. But there's been many stories now about outbreaks of COVID in jails and prisons across the U.S.
I remember that Chris covers the far right, so it's not the first time he's seen the police become violent with protesters.
But yeah, I mean, I've seen, like, in Portland, police be incredibly aggressive and use flashbang grenades against anti-fascist protesters. And then, you know, on the opposite side, I was in Charlottesville in 2017, where I saw Nazis, you know, push back against riot cops, demanding that the cops back up, and the cops backed up. So I think there is demonstrative differences in how cops treat certain protesters often.
Still, Chris found the police response at the George Floyd protests unusual.
I've witnessed a lot of police brutality at protests over the years, but I personally have not experienced this level of aggression.
And despite his experience, Chris says he feels lucky in some ways.
I am a white journalist and probably had the most privileged experience of this that a person can have, and it was still incredibly scary. So it stands to reason that they are treating people that aren't white and that aren't journalists much more harshly.
It's hard to tell from anecdotal evidence whether the police are actually targeting the press more than usual. We live in the digital age, so we're able to capture and disseminate information a lot easier.
So in part, there are just more protests, more danger zones for journalists. Also, every protest, every year that there's a protest, there's the ability to capture more and more of what's happening. There are more cameras out there, more phones.
That's Kirsten McCudden.
And I'm the managing editor of the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. That's a project that documents aggressions against the press in the United States.
We talked to Kirsten to get some sense of the real numbers. And what Kirsten told us is that actually, they've never seen anything like these arrests before.
They're unprecedented. I think we will wear out the word unprecedented before the summer is over, but the scope and scale of what we are seeing, this is really just a turning and defining moment for journalists in the U.S.
The tracker has been aggregating data about the assaults since the Black Lives Matter protests started.
And to date, we're in the middle of July. Nearly 500 aggressions against the press have been reported into the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. We're working to independently verify 68 arrests of journalists covering these protests and documenting what's going on. 220 physical attacks. Now, that is everything from being hit with a projectile to assaults. More than 100 reports of chemical agents being used. That's tear gas, pepper spray. And also about 70 equipment damages. And you have to think of how important this is for a journalist. That's newsroom damage, but that's also cameras broken, bicycles being stolen.
And here's how those numbers compare to what the tracker has seen in the past.
The tracker was started in 2017. And from 2017 to the end of 2019, we documented a little bit more than 400 press freedom aggressions. We are independently verifying 496 that have come in the past 8 weeks alone. That is more than the tracker's entire history.
And it's not just the number of attacks that stands out, but the level of violence itself.
The more police departments that have more pepper spray, more rubber bullets, with that comes a higher number of incidents of assaults. We have at least two journalists who have lost either complete vision in one eye or may lose vision in one eye. This is the militarization of police departments at local levels. I think it does make a difference with what's being used out there and the damage that it can do to citizens and also to journalists.
So what's going on here? To understand why the number of attacks on journalists have increased and what's at stake, I talked to Nora Benavides, the director of the U.S. Free Expressions Programs at Pan America. Nora Benavides says that since Trump has been elected, she's witnessed a trend.
Here in the United States, there has been a rise over the last several years in threats to free expression. That includes a lot of threats to our free press and to the ability of reporters to give readers, to give the public information about our government and to hold government accountable. And so much of what we're seeing now and why I'm so concerned about the state of free expression in the United States is that I think we are seeing a very targeted effort to minimize certain groups from being able to engage in public discourse. And what we see quite a bit is journalists, for example, that try to portray or cover, for example, the Trump administration in critical ways, they are targeted. I think we've seen some compounding crises here. We've seen the pandemic, and then we have seen anti-lockdown protests that sprang up around the country.
Trump police have betrayed the people. You work for socialist radicals.
Some of those were lauded by our president. And, you know, those people were seen, for example, by him and characterized as very good people. And so in all of that, there was kind of this fever pitch of rising tension between how certain protesters in the anti-lockdown arena were being characterized by our leaders, and then a rise in efforts to really come together in solidarity around the George Floyd and Black Lives Matter protests.
I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir? Why am I under arrest, sir?
And I remember back at the end of May when Omar Jimenez of CNN was arrested in Minneapolis. He and his crew were arrested while trying to cover a protest.
I'm about there, guys. We were just out here reporting the closure of the streets. Omar was just arrested. I believe they're about to, we're all about to be arrested. That's our producer.
I remember in that moment, it was like the next morning, I was so shocked, as I know a lot of my colleagues were, to see such an egregious violation of basic First Amendment rights of reporters trying to just cover a protest. But then that started happening again and again and again. And I honestly think that it's really a sign of the times and that we are seeing efforts to limit how people can understand what's happening around those protests. If there are no reporters to report on the police misconduct or how police officers are treating protesters, protesters may simply not know what's really going on.
And so it's absolutely an effort to frame and very carefully frame what people have access to.
One of the questions I had for Nora was the role that race played in the level of police aggression. And she said, at least in terms of who's getting arrested, it seems to be all kinds of journalists.
The interest in stamping out journalist presence at protests is not confined to journalists of color. One of the things that we noted is that then legal observers started getting picked up and arrested as well. And so it kind of echoed the way journalists were being targeted. Any effort to document or observe or provide witness to what was happening at these protests, officers were trying to limit and clamp down on.
But what is also clear from her research is that race actually plays a huge role in which movements are targeted by the police and by the government.
Recently, PEN America released a report that looks at the last 5 years of legislative proposals that have been introduced around the country to either increase penalties for protesters or somehow create new types of penalties for people who are engaging in protected activity. And what we largely saw was that there were a few ways these bills try to target groups. And they don't try to target all groups. They specifically target people who engage in activities that are known to be tactics used by Black Lives Matter and Dakota Pipeline protesters. So dozens and dozens of bills over the last several years have been introduced, we found, namely to criminalize people who march on public roadways. That was, over the last several years, a tactic used by Black Lives Matter. We've also then seen dozens and dozens of bills introduced that criminalize people who are protesting near critical infrastructure sites.
And protesting critical infrastructure, such as oil pipelines, is a tactic of indigenous protests.
All of which seems to suggest in our data and analysis that it's really these racial justice and often Black, Indigenous, and other people of color that are targeted by government.
So what do we do? How do we protect journalists in this kind of environment? If you look at some of the recommendations online right now, journalists are being told to go into work dressed as if they're entering a battlefield. That actually bothers Nora.
We should not be in the position of giving civilians or reporters ways to adapt their practices to meet what a new normal is in a more militarized environment, but we need to be looking at why we have a more militarized environment that's silencing people's free expression.
But there are two ways we can really start to push back against this level of violence. To start, we can force public officials to hold the police accountable.
Well, one of the things that PEN America is doing is we've been working with a coalition and leading efforts to call on governors and local mayor's offices to actually investigate and then hold police departments accountable for their violations of press freedom. We know that many of the cities that have the highest attacks on journalists have been places like Minneapolis, New York City, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. And so in many jurisdictions, we've actually been working with dozens of press freedom and media coalition groups to try to put pressure where we can on officials. One, for them to call out that these types of attacks are violations of the First Amendment, and to bring forward bigger accountability efforts so that in the months to come, when we do not anticipate a dampening of people's protests and civic engagement, we want local and state officials to be there at the ready to defend both reporters and protesters' First Amendment rights.
The second fix is a broader cultural change in newsrooms themselves. And this might seem unrelated, but part of the problem with journalism and how the media portrays protests, especially protests led by Black and Indigenous leaders, is that there aren't actually that many journalists of color reporting on these issues. So values like objectivity take precedence over values such as anti-imperialism or anti-fascism. And that's partially why we're in the position we're in now.
A lot of reporters said there's this reckoning over objectivity. And so we need to have Black and brown reporters in the mix reporting on issues that, frankly, other reporters that are not of color, not Black, not brown, are simply not attuned to and not thinking about what the systemic consequences are here. And when we only have a monopoly in our publishing world and in the media of white reporters, that is a failure to hold our larger communities and our government accountable for certain oversights. I mean, I loved seeing For example, you know, Wesley Lowery did a piece in the New York Times on this. It was called A Reckoning Over Objectivity, and it was led by Black journalists. And I think that this is one of those moments where one of the questions that has to be wrestled with now is, how do we deal with what the traditional standards of journalism mean when one of those is objectivity? Because that simply isn't good enough now in many instances to say it's one of our hallmarks of good and practical and ethical journalism. Instead, we now have to think about, well, what is the role from an equity lens and the value, the important value of having Black and Brown reporters able to actually hold accountable those that they're reporting on.
You were just listening to Christopher Matias, Kirsten McCudden, and Nora Benavides. And reporting from Oakland, I'm Salima Hamarani.
You're listening to A Thin Black Line, press freedom, repression, and surveillance on Making Contact. This and all of our shows are offered for free to radio stations across the country and around the world. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is making_contact. And now back to A Thin Black Line. A rallying cry of the Black Lives Matter movement has been to defund police departments, with multi-billion-dollar budgets and millions in damages from excessive force lawsuits paid by taxpayers. One big-ticket item on some police budgets is surveillance technology. Dave Moss is a senior investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a visiting professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, Reynolds School of Journalism, where he and hundreds of students built what they call the Atlas of Surveillance.
You know, as a researcher in surveillance at EFF, I get two kinds of questions asked all the time by reporters and researchers and by local community members. And the first question is, how is a particular surveillance technology spreading across the country? Who has face recognition in the U.S.? Who has license plate readers? The second question I get is not about a specific technology, but about a specific place. I live in Chicago, or I live in Seattle, or I live in Albuquerque, and what are all the technologies that my local law enforcement agencies are using? And there wasn't a good resource for answering these questions. And so eventually, you know, we were approached by the University of Nevada, Reno's Journalism School, and they asked whether we had some sort of project we could do with a large number of students, perhaps more than 150 students. And immediately I thought, we can build this database that people can come to learn about the surveillance state, to learn about what kind of technologies are in their communities, whether they're in someplace rural or in a major metropolitan area. So now, after having spent 18 months with hundreds of both student researchers as well as volunteers, members of the EFF community, we've put together the first version of the website, which has it's atlasofsurveillance.org. And it has a way for you to play around with the map to flip on and off switches to see which technologies are used by which police departments. But there's also a fairly robust search where you can put in where you live, your state, your county, your city, and it'll return a list of all the technologies we've gathered for that area, along with outlinks that you can visit in order to get more information. One of the things that we do is that we work with local organizations and grassroots groups to try to pass ordinances that require this technology to go through a public process before it's adopted. So what I mean by that is that when a police department wants body-worn cameras or drones, the idea is that police shouldn't be able to just make that decision, you know, in a back room with a salesperson from the company. Instead, they need to write up a policy, they need to assess what the impact will be on privacy and civil liberties, and they need to bring that policy and their entire proposal to the city council or a board of supervisors, whoever the elected body is, to have permission. And that gives the community the opportunity to weigh in and say what they think is appropriate or not appropriate for communities, and if they are going to allow a surveillance technology into their community, what the restrictions are on how it might be used.
Particularly with everything that's been going on recently with the federal police going out to various municipalities during these protests, what is the significance of a database tool like this?
You know, one of the reasons we put this out into the world, I mean, this is something we've been working on for a very long time, but it's also the sort of project that never ends. And we had to make a decision, when were we going to cut this off and just go live? We can keep collecting data, you know, month after month after month, but when is enough for us to put it out into the world? And so as these protests have been raging on, not just you know, we don't just have concerns about how surveillance is being used against protesters, but the protests themselves about the growth of the police state implicates all of these technologies. When we talk about defunding the police or we talk about reducing police budgets, one of the big things that police departments spend money on is surveillance technology. And so we decided that it was very important to get this out into the world as soon as possible. And so what we see in terms of people using the site is that certainly in cities where there is a lot of unrest going on or where federal law enforcement is stepping in, we see people searching our site for information about those areas. Sometimes that might become useful when, you know, making a decision about, you know, how you're going to dress and what kind of mask you're going to. Obviously, people are wearing masks quite a lot now, but, you know, because of the pandemic. But even in previous times before the pandemic, there might be a decision you might want to make about whether to wear a mask or not based on whether police are using body-worn cameras. You know, you might want to keep an eye out for drones. You might want to have an idea of what technology is being used because maybe weeks later, somebody might get arrested and you might wonder, what kind of evidence was gathered on this person? A lot of these technologies are kept secret from defense attorneys. And so it's important to know what the police have so defense attorneys can go and ask for evidence from them.
So I saw a description on the EFF website of what looks like a preliminary Atlas of Surveillance project that focused more regionally on the border communities in the Southwest. And there seem to be some pretty clear parallels between the tactics used by U.S. Border Patrol and ICE and the monitoring and the arrest of immigrant communities and the tactics that have been used by federal agents during these demonstrations against repressive policing. Is that something that EFF or the Atlas Project is keeping track of as well?
Yeah, so what you're talking about is our Atlas of Surveillance focusing on border communities. This was our pilot project last year to just to see whether we could collect the data in a useful way, how the students would be interacting with the research and interacting with our tools. And so we started, instead of looking at the full country, we looked at the 23 counties along the U.S.-Mexico border. And based on that success, we started moving around you know, more broadly across the United States. But what we've seen is that, you know, in border areas, that is where federal money is flowing in to purchase technology, either by the federal government themselves, or the federal government is funding programs like Operation Stone Garden, which gives money to local law enforcement agencies to buy technology for, you know, quote, border security purposes. And so then you start seeing iris recognition, face recognition, license plate readers, cell site simulators, the whole range of technologies starting to creep in to even the smallest border towns in the Southwest. And then that technology kind of moves its way upwards. City of San Diego, for example, is very much a testing bed for a lot of these technologies. You see some of the larger commercial drones being tested in San Diego. San Diego had one of the earliest mobile face recognition programs. And a lot of this is just coming in because it's a border region, because, you know, the courts have looked at civil liberties around the border and decided that there's, you know, diminished rights when you're near a border. And that has resulted in the Department of Homeland Security, the Drug Enforcement Agency Administration, U.S. Marshals, and a variety of federal agencies collaborating with local law enforcement to enhance data collection, surveillance technology, creating these real-time crime centers and intelligence centers that are analyzing data all the time. So you're exactly right. The border is indicative of what is to come elsewhere in the country. The Atlas of Surveillance is meant to be a collaborative project. We do want the site to serve as a resource for people trying to gather more information, but we also want to encourage people to participate and help us collect more data so we can fill out the entire map. We have information on something like 3,000 police departments across the country. There are close to 20,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States. And so certainly we need to build up our research base in order to cover more ground. The more people who are becoming literate to these issues, who are understanding how the press is covering these issues, are learning how to read public documents about these issues. So for us, part of the utility of a project like this is building up a movement that is cognizant of the rise of surveillance, in addition to just learning about it.
Mm-hmm. And where can people go to just go to atlasofsurveillance.org?
atlasofsurveillance.org. I really encourage people to click search the data, which is going to give a lot more information about where they live. But there will also be a tab called collaborate, which we have a lot of opportunities to get involved.
Again, that was Dave Moss, senior investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. This has been A Thin Black Line: Press Freedom, Repression, and Surveillance on Making Contact. This show was produced by Salima Hamarani and Monica Lopez. The Making Contact team is Executive Director Sonia Green, Director of Production Initiatives Lisa Rudman, producers Anita Johnson, Salima Hamarani, and Monica Lopez. Web updates by Sabine Blazin. And I'm this week's host, Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. 1, 2, 3.